Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah.
Don't you know we're gonna
started to burn too many things we found. That's the divine Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote most of the words to that song, except Solartopia, which I wrote. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you with another hour here in Solartopia on the Green Power and Wellness Show at PRN. Glad to have you back, PRN. I know you went through a lot of changes and it must have been a lot of hard work, but we appreciate it. We're glad to be back on the air with this truly great network. And thank you, Gary Knoll, for continuing to sustain us. I have a great show. We have a great show today because we have a great crisis in front of us. We have the great Dick Munson. Dick, you with us?
Yes, I am. How are you, Harvey?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? You're in Chicago, yeah?
Yes, I am.
And Tim Judson from Nuclear Information Resource Service. Tim, where are you?
I'm in the Washington, D.C. area, Harvey. Thanks for having me.
All right, and Kevin Camps of the Beyond Nuclear. Where are you, Kevin?
Hi, Harvey. I'm in Falls Church, Virginia.
All right, so here's the deal. I have lived most of my life in Ohio, and we are now facing the biggest scam in the history of the state. The second biggest. The biggest happened about 20 years ago when the state legislature allowed, so-called allegedly deregulated, which was utter nonsense, and handed $9 billion to the owners of the Perry and Davis Specialty Nuclear Plants in so-called stranded costs, because they came to the legislature with this scam that they wanted to have a free market in energy. But before they could have a free market in energy, they had to pay Perry and Davis Bessie $9 billion because these poor reactors couldn't compete. Complete and utter nonsense. They got the money, and now, 20 or so years later, the owners of Davis, Bessie, and Perry, which is First Energy, which is bankrupt, of course, and which blacked out the entire Northeast in 2003, 50 million people all the way up into Canada, and are sustaining two of the most dangerous reactors in the world. And in fact, this past week, there was a 4.0 Richter scale earthquake 20 miles from Perry, which was the first nuclear reactor in the world, in the country, rather, to sustain a damage from an earthquake that happened in 1986. So now First Energy is bankrupt, and they have gone into the state legislature. They're running ads all over the state on TV. It's obscene. And they are asking the state to give them about $190 million per year over market value of the electricity that they're selling, which is absolutely. And they're also wanting the entire state, not just in their service territory, but every ratepayer in the state of Ohio, to pay higher electric rates so that Perry and Davis Bessie can continue to operate. I mean, it is absolutely infuriating and extremely dangerous. So you three guys, we're going to do the whole hour on this because we want to make a record of what's really going on here. And most importantly, how it could be stopped. So, Dick Munson, let's start with you. You've written extensively on this, and just tell us your perspective on it, where you're coming from, and what you think we need to do.
Well, as you have noted, First Energy is not the best run of companies. They made some really stupid decisions. Most particularly, they decided to double down on coal plants at the very moment that natural gas prices were falling. And not long thereafter, their coal investments were uneconomic, and certainly their nuclear reactors have been uneconomic. As you noted, they've been paid in subsidies many times. They're back now looking for more. And they advanced this bill before the Ohio legislature. It's called HB 6 or House Bill 6. But they were framing it as a clean air bill, oddly enough, because they were arguing that nuclear reactors don't emit carbon, and therefore this was a means to compensate them for that attribute. Well, the bill, as it ended up passing the House, not only subsidized the nuclear reactors to the tune, as you said, of $190 million per year for the foreseeable future, but it also subsidized what are called the OVEC coal-fired power plants, which are not exactly, if you will, a clean air measure. And then at the same time, just to add icing on the cake to make this bill even more abhorrent, they got rid of all of the efficiency and renewable energy programs. So here we have this bill that is now before the Senate, and I think all of us in various states and with a wide coalition are trying to block it.
Yeah, and I want to point out, just for the record, that one of those coal plants is in Indiana. I mean, these guys, there's no shame here. These guys just obviously believe they can get away with anything. Tim Jensen, you want to jump in?
Yeah, well, it's one of the, you know, the ways in which First Energy is trying to skew this whole conversation is by, you know, making it seem like Ohio isn't going to be able, you know, to supply its own energy needs if, you know, or you know, if Davis, Bessie, and Perry shut down. And what you got to realize is that, you know, that those two power plants only represent about 12% of the total amount of electricity that Ohio consumes every year. So, you know, I mean, other states are setting renewable energy standards at, you know, 25, 30, 50%. To achieve, you know, within a few years from now, which is, you know, which if Ohio followed that same kind of path, you know, replacing Davis, Bessie, and Perry would be a no-brainer. It's just that, you know, First Energy has essentially rigged state energy policy in Ohio to make it virtually impossible for renewable energy to be developed. And I think one of the things that was interesting to see this week was an op-ed that was published in one of the papers by, you know, a woman who is from Ohio, who works on building renewable energy projects in other states all over the country, and who would like to go and be able to do the same thing in Ohio, but can't.
Can you forward that to me? I didn't see that one. If you could forward that, the URL on that one, Tim, I'd appreciate it. And since you mentioned that, let me throw in here the wind setback. Now, this is an utterly outrageous piece that they put in, the Republicans put into the Ohio Code, and it has no apparent function other than to prevent wind power in the state of Ohio from progressing. And it's a setback clause. It's in the Ohio Code. It was put in, I think, in 2015, and it basically makes an impossible demand on wind farms in terms of how far away from the roads and buildings that the windmills need to be. And it's like two or three times the setback that is involved in most other states and virtually all other states in the country. And what it's done is effectively prevent wind energy from proceeding in Ohio, even though Ohio actually has tremendous resources along the the North Coast, along the Lake Erie shore. Kevin Camps, your turn here.
Hey, Harvey. Well, I just want to make clear to everybody that's a very basic physical fact that the wind simply stops at the Ohio border. I mean, you can see on the Indiana side, you know, large wind turbine farms, and they just magically stop at the border. So you're right. It's been a devastating policy in Ohio. I mean, HB 6 is like taking a step back into the 1950s, essentially. So, I don't know. I'm very encouraged by the
protests that are erupting around the state against HB 6. There have been protests in Toledo, Columbus a couple times now, Akron. I see there's going to be one in Cincinnati next Monday. And they've got a giant inflatable pig, apparently a commentary on pigs at the trough, which is traveling around. That's going to be in Medina and Bowling Green next week on Monday, I think. So people, ratepayers, environmentalists, retired people are speaking up. This is not ordinary what's going down with this legislation, and people are letting it be known. And as I've talked with you about, you know, a number of times on your show, Harvey, the thing we keep bringing to the table is these are also not ordinary reactors. And I have a lot more knowledge and experience at Davis-Besse, but you've got a reactor there that's had more close calls with catastrophe than any other in the United States. And the problems just get worse. It's deep into its breakdown phase where major safety systems could simply snap. And you don't want that to happen. And the part that doesn't get mentioned too often is these big bailouts that they're trying to put in their pocket. Little to none of that money would go towards fixing these major nuclear safety systems, components, structures at Davis-Besse that are desperately in need of repair. But they're not going to spend a penny of money to do that. They're just going to run them into the ground and see what happens.
Oh, God. It's devastating, absolutely devastating. Dick Munson?
The other thing that's sort of overwhelming is just the lobbying campaign, just the arrogance of thinking that you can buy a bailout. You had noted before that there are television ads all over the state of Ohio, claiming how wonderful these power plants are, and if they close, thousands of people will lose their jobs and the air will become, horrible. First Energy spent well over $1 million on political campaigns, both for the governor and to help get the speaker elected. They're spending almost $3 million on lobbyists. The Americans for Prosperity, I think this is one of the most odd coalitions you can ever come up with. There's certainly a lot of protests from environmental and anti-nuke groups, but Americans for Prosperity, which are the Koch brothers funded, believe that Ohio should be focused on markets rather than bailouts. So they're opposed as well, and in fact came up with this statistic that noting all of these expenditures on lobbyists and campaign contributions, First Energy is about to get a 3,000% return on their investment. I mean, it's crass. And even this conservative group was suggesting that it is corporate cronyism that any average American would not be able to get anything such a deal from their government on anything they ever asked for. So I think it's abhorrent both from an energy perspective, but from a democracy perspective, just the arrogance of thinking that they can get away with buying themselves subsidies.
Well, they're about to get away with it. I mean, I was just in Columbus, and very, very few people think that the Senate is going to vote against this. The vote in the Ohio House was 43. What was it? Now I can't remember. There's a 10-vote margin in the House, and there were 10 Democrats who voted for this thing, and 17 Republicans voted against it. There are some actual free market Republicans in the House there, but essentially, what First Energy has shown is that you can buy the Ohio legislature for $3 million. That's the price they have set now. That's what they spent last year on lobbying, most of which, of course, went towards this bailout. And, Dick, as you pointed out, they spent $1 million around the state. And I got to tell you, this is one of the greatest strange bedfellow story in my entire career. In 2004, J. Kenneth Blackwell, the first African-American voted to a statewide office in Ohio, was the Secretary of State. And he is the one who basically stole the 2004 election with Karl Rove to get George W. Bush a second term. And we were just blood enemies. I mean, I ran into him once, and it was not a lot of fun. but well, it was a lot of fun actually. But Kenneth Blackwell has been hired by somebody, I think the oil and gas people, and he had an op-ed in the Columbus Dispatch against the corporate cronyism that's involved with this bailout. It was, you know, Bob Fitrakis, my co-author, and I were trying to track him down so we could get a picture taken together. It'd be a lot of fun. But, you know, the Koch brothers are against this, and, of course, the fossil fuel people, and, of course, whatever solar and wind industries there are in Ohio. But you have to remember that the top seven executives, the seven best paid executives at First Energy, are paid a collective of more than $20 million a year. Chuck Jones, the CEO of First Energy, is paid $9.5 million a year. And he's driven that company into bankruptcy. I mean, imagine what he can make if they're actually making a profit. It's absolutely sickening. Tim Judson, you want to comment on this?
Yeah, well, I mean, this really goes down to a question of what this bailout is really about. I mean, this is now, I think, probably the fourth or fifth time that First Energy has come to the state of Ohio for a bailout for these same plants in the last 5 years, starting in 2014. I mean, this, you know, so, I mean, this is actually, we've been having this same debate now for over 5 years. And First Energy has lost every time up to this point for one reason or another. But the reality is that, you know, First Energy doesn't even really have a dog in the fight on Davis, Bessie, and Perry anymore. The closure dates for those two reactors have been set. You know, for Davis, Bessie is supposed to close down, next year, and Perry the year after that. And it has actually spun off through this bankruptcy process, both Davis, Bessie, and Perry and its other nuclear and coal plants into a separate company that it doesn't actually own anymore. And so why is First Energy still fighting for a bailout for reactors that it doesn't actually own and it doesn't have a stake in anymore? And I think the reality is that, you know, what this is about is keeping these reactors and coal plants online perpetuates First Energy's business model, which is to sell as much electricity as possible and to not let renewables and energy efficiency, you know, into the market, which really means that, like, that basically what First Energy is doing is taking a stand against addressing climate change and against being able to transition to a clean energy future. And that's really what this bill is actually about. And that's why you see it constantly marrying the nuclear bailout, with cutting renewable energy and energy efficiency programs. First Energy is trying to keep us from being able to move to a clean energy future, plain and simple.
Kevin?
Yeah, one factoid I learned when we were fighting the license extension at Davis Bessie. So they were supposed to close on Earth Day of 2017. That was the end of their 40-year license. And it seemed like poetic justice to me that would have been a good day to close on Earth Day. So I discovered, because we were raising, you know, alternatives to 20 more years at Davis Bessie, that wind power, like you said, Harvey, in Ohio is a tremendously huge potential to tap. It's barely being tapped at this point. And so one of the things I learned was that the inventor, who was a competitor of Thomas Edison, his name was Charles Brush, in the Cleveland area, in the year 1887, generated the world's first wind-powered electricity. The world's first wind-powered electricity. What he did was he built a turbine in behind his house. It was very large in size, and the turbine supplied power to batteries, and the batteries were used to illuminate his house with artificial light. This was in 1887, and it just kind of shows that there's a lot of wind in Ohio that could be tapped. People tapped it a very long time ago. And there is some hope. I mean, there is some progress in the Cleveland area, for example. And I'll just mention that Sierra Club, a couple years ago, 2016, declared Cleveland to be one of the first cities in the country that they were going to work hard to try to make 100% renewable energy. So like Tim just laid out, we're at a crossroads, and First Energy and its friends in the Ohio legislature want to step back to the 1950s. And the rest of us would like there to be a future. That's why it's got to be renewable, and we got to stop baking the planet.
Well, let's point out a few things. You're 100% right about that. Charles Brush was a competitor to Edison, who's also from Ohio, and he did build the first wind turbine for electricity in Cleveland, and then Cleveland was the first city to have streetlights because the Brush set up the streetlights, and when they turned them on, people actually fainted in Cleveland when the streetlights went on. But Cleveland, the wind resource, if you don't mind, let me describe in northern Ohio. On the land, it's really unique and remarkable because the land is flat. It's very easy to build wind farms along the north coast, say 20, 30 miles along south of Lake Erie there. And I went in there about 10, 15 years ago, actually with a wind developer, and we were talking to the farmers, and the farmers were desperate for these wind turbines. I mean, you stick a wind turbine on the farm, you lose virtually no farmland at all, because the footprint of a wind turbine is extremely small. And you don't even really, you have to build a road up to the site to get the equipment in, but you don't have to pave it. And a lot of times the farmers will just plant right over it on the presumption that they won't need to get a truck back in there again. And then if you do, well, you just drive over the corn, and that's the end of it. And so the farmers are really happy for the lease payments. And the wind up there is not as strong as in the Dakotas down to Texas in the Great Plains there, but it's still pretty good. And so it's plenty strong for a commercial windmill, and the sites are close to the urban areas where the power would be consumed. And most important is that northern Ohio is crisscrossed with transmission, so they don't have to build the transmission lines. So it's almost an ideal setup on land for the wind. And then in the Lake Erie, it's spectacular. And if you look at the wind maps of the world, Lake Erie is as strong as in terms of steady, powerful winds as anywhere on this planet. And the lake is relatively shallow, and the sites are not that far from the cities, and it's fresh water. You know, even today they're having problems with wind turbines in the salt water because of corrosion. You don't have that in Lake Erie. And they're about to put in, the city of Cleveland, I believe, has contracted with somebody to put in some windmills finally in the lake, in Lake Erie. But you would have more than enough wind power in the North Coast and in Lake Erie to generate electricity for the whole region. I mean, it's ridiculous. And yet, you know, First Energy is there standing in the way. So here's the question, Dick Munson. How do we stop this? I mean, what happened in 2018, and the Koch brothers, for all their opposition, are partly responsible for this, because if there's anywhere in the country that's been masterfully gerrymandered, it's Ohio. I mean, Ohio is about 50-50 Democrat-Republican. It's a classic swing state. And yet the legislature is two-thirds to three-quarters Republican, and the congressional delegation is 12-4 Republican. And this is a large part the Koch brothers doing. So, you know, in the House, it was 53-43, by the way, the vote. And in the House is about, I think, two-thirds Republican, and the Senate, I think, is three-quarters Republican. So what are we going to do here? Dick Munson, what do you think?
Well, let me first just note, as you identified, Ohio is blessed with enormous renewable resources, and this bill, it sort of just smacks that advantage away. But I would argue that this problem is more than an Ohio problem. You're seeing even the Trump administration send its, you know, campaign people into Ohio to call up legislators to try to convince them that they need to approve this bill, because having these plants continue to operate and have employment will be good for President Trump's re-election. So there's a lot of forces that are running against us. But I think, as both Kevin and Tim said, the opposition, particularly from the left, has been growing with protests. But I was listening to the testimony yesterday in the Senate committee where almost these were just the proponents of the bill were getting really tough questions, both from Democrats and from Republicans. So I may have rose-colored glasses on here, but I'm not willing to give up yet. I think that there's a real opportunity to take advantage of this really weird coalition that includes, you know, groups like ours, as well as the Koch brothers and the American Petroleum Institute, to have conservatives recognize that they should embrace markets instead of bailouts, and to have the liberals recognize that they need to transition to take advantage of the huge renewable and clean resources that Ohio has.
Well, you know, I'm from Ohio. You know, I grew up there, and when I going into the state house, it's like it's a dead zone, man. I mean, you know, it's just I can't. I'm almost speechless. I was in Ohio when Dick Celeste was governor, and when John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum were our senators, and somewhere the state went into the twilight zone. And, you know, the Ohio Democratic Party is brain dead. I mean, they just don't get it. They don't fight for us. They don't, they're not there. They drove Dennis Kucinich out of the state. And so, yes, we have some nice Democrats and they supported us and there are tough questions. I don't know. I think we have to be prepared. Well, let me let Tim and Kevin comment and then let's talk further. Tim, what do you got to say about what Dick has said here?
Well, I think the longer this debate goes on, you know, the harder it's going to be for the Senate to vote First Energy's way on this. You know, what we're already seeing, you know, coming out over the last several weeks is just this drumbeat of information about how First Energy is trying to corrupt Ohio politics just in order to get this corporate bailout. And, you know, and so now that you got the Trump administration, you know, making calls to legislators to try to convince them that if they don't support this bailout, that that somehow the Republican Party is going to lose in Ohio is just, is just another example of how they'll say anything in order to get these things through. I mean, we saw the same thing happen in New York in a sort of a different way where the governor of the state, you know, pushed the nuclear bailout. The Democratic governor of the state pushed the nuclear bailout because he was, you know, because he somehow became convinced that he was going to lose the election if these nuclear plants in Republican counties in upstate New York closed down. Well, you know, he got the bailout through $7.5 billion, and the election happened, you know, a year and a half later. And guess what? He still lost those counties. so the politics of these bailouts, you know, isn't going to swing voters, to support Republicans or vote against Democrats. It's, you know, this is just a way for First Energy to try to pull the strings on legislators who, don't understand the issues well enough, to be able to, to know what's what. But the longer this debate goes on, the more it's going to become clear that you just can't trust anything that First Energy says or anything that the proponents of these bailouts, sort of say in favor of them.
Kevin?
Well, I was just going to sing all three of your praises. I mean, Dick's recent blog where he points out the contradictions in First Energy's arguments, he has the one line in there about First Energy taking its ball and going home. And what that is really is at its heart a threat against the workforces of these plants, the tax revenues to local communities, even charitable organizations to local nonprofits that are dependent on First Energy, which has been in a place like Davis Bessie since the mid-1970s. And, you know, Tim did some of the best work in the country on pointing out that a just transition is needed. And Harvey, you've been calling for retaining the workforce, retraining the workforce. Tim's white paper was in the context of Fitzpatrick in New York, but it very much applies at Davis Bessie and Perry. We've been talking about the potential for renewables in the state. So essentially what First Energy is doing is, you know, tremendous damage to the economy of Ohio, the opportunity costs. And I think there's plenty of excellent arguments out there that show the way to a better future. And it's just the fight is on.
Well, okay. So, one thing I want to get in real clear here, and then and we'll back up and we'll go in reverse. I am terrified, as are anybody who pays any attention with what could happen with Perry and David Spessy. I mean, I was just on RTTV, and this woman who just knew nothing is going on and on about nuclear power. And I think we're at a stage now where we no longer, nuclear power is not the issue. You know, I think that we don't even, I'm not worried about new reactors being built. Even the small ones are completely out to lunch in terms of a competitive advantage. And we're seeing, the Vogtle reactors in Georgia coming in at $30 billion. I mean, come on, you know, it's done. What we do have is 97, and thank God, let's celebrate the Pilgrim is shut, reactors that are still operating. And each one of those reactors is a national issue because every one of them could blow up, and we all know that. So, Kevin, real quickly, can you give us the specifics of the dangers that we're looking at Davis, Bessie, and Perry? And then I want to, unfortunately, make an assumption that this thing passes the Ohio Senate. The governor has already said he's going to sign it. And let's figure out where we go next. And also, I want to talk about a referendum. But Dave, Kevin, can you tell us in 5 minutes or less exactly what we're looking at Perry and Davis Bessie in terms of likelihood of an explosion, a major accident?
Well, I can do a better job at Davis Bessie. One of the safety risks that's gotten the most attention since 2011 is the cracking of the shield building, which is it's the very tall concrete cylinder that you can see from the outside, and the reactor is inside of it. And it came out in October of 2011 that serious cracking was discovered during a refueling outage. And it turns out that the entire building is cracked, and it's so bad, this came out shortly before the Nuclear Regulatory Commission rubber-stamped the 20-year license extension, and First Energy was so close to the finish line that they were willing to be more honest about things. And they admitted to the Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards that spalling of large chunks of concrete from the exterior face of the shield building raining down onto safety systems below could be a problem in the future. And so in that sense, they didn't admit this, but if you connect the dots, the collapse of the shield building or a portion of it could initiate a meltdown. You could take out a safety system needed to cool the reactor. And then, of course, because the shield building has just collapsed, if a meltdown occurs, the shield building is not going to contain the large release of hazardous radioactivity into the environment. So that's one issue at Davis-Bessie is the shield building. You know, if they want to keep operating for 20 more years, then they should replace the shield building. And how much would that cost? Well, it probably costs several billion dollars to do that. So they don't want to do that. And then I'll just quickly run down some other major safety issues at Davis-Bessie. Reactor pressure vessel embrittlement, which is a plague of pressurized water reactors. Davis-Bessie's got that. There's corrosion of the inner steel containment vessel, another element of the containment structure, because of an epidemic of boric acid leaks at Davis-Bessie. And the most infamous boric acid leak at Davis-Bessie was the 2002 hole-in-the-head fiasco, where they nearly corroded through the lid of the reactor, and then there would have been no contingency. If the lid had burst, there would have been a meltdown, and then it would just have been a question of, could the containment have held it in? We now know, because of the cracking, probably not, even in 2002. And I'll just end to try to communicate to folks how dangerous Davis-Bessie is with a story from, of all places, Ukraine. I was there in 2006 for the 20th anniversary of Chernobyl. I was at the Shadow Conference that was organized by NIRS from the United States. Tim's the ED at NIRS. And I was listening to a Chernobyl whistleblower speaking. He was either speaking Ukrainian or Russian, and I had headphones on because there was simultaneous translation into English. And I heard him say Davis-Bessie before the translation came through, and I just about fell out of my chair. What he was saying was, I've been talking at length about how dangerous RBMK reactors are, this Russian design, but you know, there's other designs that are also very dangerous. Let me tell you about Davis-Bessie near Toledo, Ohio. And he began to talk about the hole-in-the-head fiasco that's just occurred. So it's, you know, I often say that it's one of the most dangerous in the country, but there's some evidence that it's beyond this country how dangerous Dave Espessi is in the rankings.
Right, and we know, of course, that Perry was the first nuclear plant damaged by an earthquake in 1986, about the same time that the Challenger blew up, actually, and it did end roads and bridges and also damage to the actual reactor, but it wasn't open at the time, thankfully. They were just getting it finished up. And the governor of Ohio at the time, Dick Celeste, went to court to prevent the reactor from going online before they could study the earthquake impact on evacuation. And Celeste put in a three-man commission, the head of the Highway Patrol, the head of the PUC, and the head of Disaster Services, and they were studying evacuation, and they opened the plant anyway before the study was done. And he lost in court. The NRC told him to take a hike, and they opened the reactor, and then they finished the report, and the report was unanimously that they couldn't evacuate Perry in case of an earthquake. Couldn't do it at all. And, you know, I'd like to know is anybody familiar with the NRC ever having conducted a test with a mock-up control room where the operators try to operate the reactor while it's shaking? I'd love to see the results of such a test. But let's move. Tim, I want to go back to you, and then Dick. You are in the process of fighting a bailout that has already passed. And Dick, I know you're involved with the one in Illinois, and you're in New York. So I'm gonna throw out that let's say that they pass the bill, and the governor signs it. What do we do next, Tim? What would you recommend?
Well, you know, there's always you know, the possibility that that someone could mount a legal challenge to the legislation, depending on, you know, what it's, you know, depending on the terms of what's actually adopted. So there's that. But I think there's also, you know, but I think assuming that they've at least dotted their I's and crossed their T's well enough to, you know, to put together a piece of legislation that isn't going to flagrantly violate the state constitution or federal law, you know, there's going to need to be a lot of work to basically roll this back at some point. And you know, and set Ohio on a, you know, on a better energy policy path going forward. I mean, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy to just undo this once it's done. And we've seen that happen in the other states, where in New York and Illinois, and now in New Jersey and Connecticut. I mean, these subsidies are getting locked in for a decade to 12 years at a time. And this is the critical period in which we need to be transforming our entire energy system to renewables and, you know, and energy efficiency and other ways of reducing carbon emissions. And if we're locking these bailouts in for 10 to 12 years, you know, we're missing a huge opportunity to be able to actually do the things that we need to do, both, you know, to fuel our economy with, you know, with the transformation to green energy, but also to be able to get our hands around the climate crisis. These bailouts are standing directly in the way of all that.
Well, where do you stand now? I know you've been in court for a while. Where do you stand on the court challenge to the bailout in New York?
Well, we're waiting for a ruling from a judge. You know, we've been at it fighting the state of New York and Exelon and Entergy for over 2 years now, and you know, showing exactly, you know, how this bailout in New York was ran through, you know, illegally and improperly in violation of state law and the state constitution. We're waiting for the judge to weigh the evidence and to come down with a ruling on it.
In what court?
It's the New York Supreme Court, which is, you know, in the weird way in which the New York judicial system is set up, is actually the lowest level of state court in New York, not the highest as it is in the federal system.
Okay. And are you involved in any other suits in addition to New York?
No, we're not. In fact, you know, the other major legal challenges that have been mounted against these bailouts have been mounted by, you know, at the federal level, challenging these subsidies as violations of federal law, you know, in terms of, you know, affecting the way that the energy markets are regulated. And those lawsuits have actually failed, and judges have decided against them. And it's not clear whether there's going to be any meaningful appeal to the Supreme Court. But it seems that those lawsuits have failed. And really the only one standing that has any viability is our lawsuit in the state of New York.
Dick Munson.
Harvey, if I might just, there's another lawsuit which is challenging First Energy Solutions' attempt to use bankruptcy as a means to get around their obligations for cleaning up coal ash ponds as well as decommissioning nuclear reactors. That's ongoing. First Energy was scolded by the bankruptcy judge just a few weeks ago on their attempt to shield themselves from all future liability, even though they, you know, owned the plants for many, many years. We're now in the process of trying to demonstrate to the judge that the potential costs associated with their environmental responsibilities are significantly higher than they're trying to convince the judge or their creditors that they are. So that battle also continues. And that's, I think, just another example of First Energy's greed of trying to figure out anybody other than themselves and their huge salaries that you noted before, about $9.9 million of an annual salary for Chuck Jones, the CEO. He's not willing to take a haircut on that, but he's willing to, you know, have future generations, you know, face the costs of environmental cleanup if he gets his way. And we're trying to stop him in the bankruptcy court.
What organization are you in court with, Dick? What's the name of it?
Well, there's a few of us. It's the Environmental Law and Policy Center and the Environmental Defense Fund are two of the three. And we're working with a variety of consultants to help us try to determine through an independent audit as to what the likely real costs are of cleaning up these coal ash, you know, toxic sites, as well as decommissioning, you know, dirty, old, brittle power plants.
Are you aware of any other legal actions being taken against the against bailouts?
Nothing comes to mind at the moment. Only, okay. I guess, because I've been so focused on this bankruptcy one.
Okay.
To go back to a question that you posed before, as what do we do if this passes? Number one, I guess I would say I'm not willing to throw in the towel. I think, you know, as I think Tim had noted before, the longer this drags on and the more reports that come out, including one just, I think, about a week ago from PJM, which is the regional grid operator, who said that not only would the bailout cost the $190 million annually in subsidies, but that it would cost ratepayers some $16 million a year in lost savings because it would discourage cheaper and more efficient generators. So there's a lot of evidence that keeps coming down. If, in fact, we do lose, you made some reference to a referendum. That is a possibility in Ohio, and it's costly to mount such a thing, but I think the little bit of polling that has been done would suggest that this bailout of First Energy's mistakes is very unpopular in the state. So there is a potential to basically overturn the legislation through a referendum, which I think all of us are looking at, hopefully with realistic eyes, because it's not cheap. There are five media markets, as you well know. In Ohio, it's a tough place to run a referendum, but this bill is so bad, if it does pass anywhere close to its current form, I think the odds of overturning it with a referendum are pretty high.
Kevin?
Well, that's very encouraging news. I mean, there have been such tremendous victories, not necessarily by referendum, but at the Sacramento Municipal Utility District in 1989, where the people of Sacramento voted to shut down Rancho Seco atomic reactor. Missouri did pass a referendum against construction work in progress charges on people's electric bills, which essentially killed a second reactor at Callaway in that state. So that's a very hopeful, you know, plan B, I guess. I wanted to say that what this pitched battle, this open warfare, essentially, between First Energy and just about everybody else in the state, gives us an opportunity for is public education. And one issue I wanted to bring up is to look again at what might happen if the worst happens at a place like Davis Bessey. So I'm looking at, right now, a report from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's most commonly referred to as the CRAC 2 report. That's short for Calculation of Reactor Accident Consequences. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission commissioned Sandia National Lab of New Mexico to carry out this study of what would the casualties and the property damages look like downwind of nuclear power plants if they had a meltdown. And the results were so bad that the NRC tried to conceal the results. And Ed Markey, who was a U.S. rep at the time and now a U.S. senator from Massachusetts, forced the outing of these figures. And so I'm looking at the Davis Bessey figures. And so for peak early fatalities, post-meltdown, these are radiation poisoning acute deaths, 1,400. Radiation injuries, 73,000. And peak cancer deaths, which means latent cancer fatalities over a course of years or decades, the figure is 10,000. And the figure for property damages in 1982 dollar figures is $84 billion. And when adjusted for inflation, that's closer to $200 billion in today's dollars. And I'll just close by sharing a really kind of ghoulish story, I guess, very revealing about the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board, and at least the law firm, but also First Energy itself and the law firm it hired. Morgan Bacchius, I believe, is the name of the law firm. So we were in Port Clinton on March 1st of 2011, and as all of you will realize, that's 10 days before Fukushima began in Japan. And we're at a oral argument pre-hearing of the licensing board on the Davis Bessey 20-year license extension. And when we brought up our side, our coalition of environmental groups fighting the license extension, the CRAC 2 report and these, you know, nightmarish casualties and property damages that could result if the worst happened to Davis Bessey, this was the response of the other side. The law firm of First Energy objected, saying, "We don't know what you're referring to. What is this CRAC 2?" And then the NRC staff was turned to. They didn't know what I was talking about either. And also, even the licensing board, they just didn't know what I was talking about. And so the official name of CRAC 2 is actually New Reg CR 2239, which I have a hard time memorizing. It's also referred to as the 1982 Sandia Siting Study. And what is so sickening about that response that day, 10 days before Fukushima began, in Port Clinton, so close to Davis Bessey, is that one of the licensing board judges, named Trikouros, was actually one of the developers of the CRAC 2 computer code. So I think he probably did know what it stood for, what it meant, what I was talking about. And that's the level of cynicism of the other side on these safety matters.
Well, it's pretty sick, and it's really, really terrifying. I mean, either Perry or Davis Bessey blows up, and you lose the entire North Coast and the Great Lakes, the greatest source of fresh water in the world. So here's a strategic question. If somebody drafted a referendum prior to the vote on this bailout and circulated it in the legislature, showing that this was going to be challenged, I mean, it's been estimated it costs about $5 million to do a referendum, get it on the ballot, and do a campaign in Ohio. I don't think there's any doubt that we would win and this thing would be repealed. So the question is, should we draft it now and circulate it? And should we also draft the lawsuit? Somebody's going to sue, obviously, if this thing passes. It will go to court one way or the other. I think that should be made clear to the legislature. I want to point out also, by the way, that this isn't the only state we're having trouble. In California, we have another bankrupt utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, and they refuse to inspect the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant. We have circulated a petition in California to get the Diablo Canyon reactors inspected. We got all sorts of stars, A-list stars, Mimi Kennedy, Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Frances Fisher, Lila Garrett, Jody Evans, Martin Sheen, Eric Roberts, Ed Asner, to sign this petition, Graham Nash. And we sent it into the governor, and we have gotten zero response. All we asked for was an inspection of two reactors at Diablo Canyon, and they haven't responded. But, Kevin, I'm glad you pointed out that we have some referenda. Dick Munson, you're very familiar with the legal process. Do you know some good lawyers that might draft up a petition and a lawsuit that we could send to the legislature before they vote on this thing?
Let's just say we have been having some discussions, both with lawyers and with some legislators, about that very prospect. I'd like to not spend $5 million if I can get away with it. So trying to focus my attention on killing this thing in the Senate, where we always thought we had our best chance, in large part simply because it seems counterintuitive, but because it is more conservative from a free market perspective than the Ohio House is, that's where at least I thought we had our best chance of killing it, and I still think that we can.
Well, I'm interested to hear that. That's very. Are you going to go to Columbus to testify?
Yep. Next week will be opponent testimony. They just had proponent testimony. As I mentioned, the proponent testimony was very interesting yesterday, in that both Republicans and Democrats gave the bill sponsors a really hard time. And I think First Energy came off looking kind of stupid.
Well, that's not hard for First Energy. that's their one form of natural energy. Well, I am going to strongly recommend that there be a petition drawn up and a lawsuit drawn up and submitted to the legislators before they vote. I think they need to make it clear to these people that this is not going to end. If they pass this thing, it's not going to end it. I mean, I saw an ad on TV in Columbus, a whole very expensive full 60-second ad. And at the end, all these local people in northern Ohio saying how wonderful the plant is. And at the end, they slashed one state senator's name and asked whoever saw the ad to call this guy. Now, that's how much money they're throwing around at this thing. And I just am of the opinion that I also think that the money will come for a referendum, because some of the industrial users in Ohio are going to get killed by this. It will drive industry out of the state. And I think that if a referendum was put forward, that the money would, it's $5 million against $190 million. I think that the money would come. And I think it should be made clear to these legislators, these senators, that if they vote for this, it's not the end of it. And nobody doubts in Ohio that they would get killed in a referendum. I mean, that is an absolute certainty. The question is, can we get it past the Secretary of State? So we're almost out of time. Real quick, Tim, you want to jump in?
Yeah, a couple of points, Harvey, that are real, I think, cautionary notes for legislators as they're thinking about this. And one is actually to correct something I said a few minutes ago, which is there actually is another legal process going on in New Jersey over the New Jersey bailout, where the State Utility Commission had to basically decide whether the reactors in New Jersey were unprofitable enough or at risk of closing to justify the $300 million a year in subsidies that the legislature approved. And the New Jersey Rate Council, as well as the Independent Market Monitor from PJM, which is the regional grid operator, have strongly objected to these subsidies being justified on that basis. Basically, all three of these reactors in New Jersey are extremely profitable. And the real reason that the utilities want this bailout is basically to increase the profit to a level that they're happy with. This is
sort of, my God. Hey, listen,
the kind of duplicity and outrageous, reasoning that we conceived.
We got what we needed. Thank you so much, Tim. Unfortunately, I got to go. I hope you draft up this stuff. Thank you, Tim, Kevin, Dick. You guys are great. We'll be back on this.